Home Life in Bible Times, a Study in Biblical Antiquities, written and illustrated by Arthur W. Klink. Preface. The text, Home Life in Bible Times, a Study in Biblical Antiquities, aims to make our church school teachers and general Bible students more familiar with the everyday life of Bible people as a background for their understanding and appreciation of the Holy Scriptures and for the improvement of their teaching of biblical truth. The contents pages show that no attempt has been made to cover the whole field of biblical antiquities, which is too large and diversified to be treated in one course of our Concordia series. Thus, public life, civil, legal, and military, in New Testament times, the theocratic Old Testament state, the Levitical ordinances, the daily worship, the periodical festivals centering in the tabernacle and the temple, and the development of public education in the local synagogue, significant and interesting as they are, have been passed over except for a few instances, such as the brief section on religious education in the home. These and other topics will have to wait for treatment in a later course. No apology is made for the amount of space given to the various topics treated in the text. The author's selection was largely dictated by what he considered to be the needs and interests of church school teachers as he has come to know them through his contacts with many hundreds of them in a variety of areas during the past two decades. Some important material is passed over very briefly because it has been treated so often and so fully elsewhere as to have become common knowledge. Some materials have been expanded because of its special value in the personal life and teaching of the religious worker. All of it provides but a series of glimpses into the riches of God's Word in the setting of its human background. If those who read these pages privately or study them in organized classes are led just a little deeper into the beauty and instruction and comfort of the inspired writings, the author will feel richly rewarded. Although the curators of several museums generously granted permission to reproduce photographs taken in the Near East or in their own archaeological collections, it seemed best for our present purpose not to use halftones or even to make direct copies, but to present very simple pen and ink sketches, giving only essential detail so that church school teachers can readily understand them and even draw some of them on the chalkboard in clarification of the biblical history lesson. Many of the author's illustrations are of composite origin, resulting from the comparison of actual ancient remains in the museum collections with their modern Near East equivalent, or with a traveler's word picture of it. In presenting this study, the author wishes to express his deep appreciation to all those who have given him permission to study their collections or have been helpful to him in tracking down one or another small but elusive bit of information. Special gratitude is due Dr. Watson Boyes, curator of the Oriental Institute Museum, University of Chicago, Professor C.T. Curley, director of the Royal Ontario Museum of Archaeology, Toronto, Dr. H.E. Winlock, director, and Dr. Ludlow Bull of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York, Mrs. Loring Dam, curator of the Education Department, University of Pennsylvania Museum, Philadelphia, Dr. Sidney Smith, keeper of the Department of Egyptian and Assyrian Antiquities, British Museum, London, for permission to make a detailed study and comparison of the archaeological material under their care, along with the pertinent photographs, periodicals, and books in their collections. To many of his colleagues in the ministry and the Christian teaching profession who have been his students in institutes or informal classes in biblical antiquities, the author expresses his appreciation for the stimulation and encouragement which made the text seem worthwhile to begin and follow through. Finally, to the members of the Church School Teacher Training Committee, as well as to the publisher, Dr. Otto A. Dorn, he offers sincere thanks for their unfailing cooperation. A.K. Chapter 1. Primitive Outdoor Occupations. Introduction. Man's work before and after the fall. When God placed man into the Garden of Eden, one of his purposes was that man live a life of wholesome activity. Though the Garden of Eden must have had many beautiful spots suitable for a life of ease and rest, God put man into this garden to work, to dress it and to keep it. Genesis 2:15. The everyday tasks of the farmer were to be his lot. In sowing and cultivating and pruning and gathering fruit, he was to find happiness and contentment and to make a living for himself and for his family. He was to know the feeling of physical well-being that comes with bodily exertion. He was to experience the mental satisfaction of planning his work in advance, so that, according to God's command, he would be able to subdue the earth. Genesis 1:28. If work was necessary for man's well-being before the fall, it was doubly necessary after sin had entered the world. Now Adam and Eve began that war with nature which man has had to fight ever since. The ground suffered the curse of God for man's sake. Thorns and thistles hampered his efforts. The earth no longer yielded her fruit. In the sweat of his brow, man toiled and ate his bread. Genesis 3:17-19. Some of the blessings of work. Although the necessity of work must have seemed to Adam a burdensome curse of God, it was really a blessing in disguise. Through much careful planning and more hard labor, he was able to force a living from the reluctant soil. And in the fatigue that followed this hard physical exertion, he found peaceful rest. In work, too, he found an antidote for the sins of regretful brooding and despair. Work helped him to curb the sinful desires of his flesh, his pride, and the urge he must often have felt to blame Eve for the fallen state of the race. The sons of Adam and Eve learned to work as farmers and shepherds, thus dividing the chief tasks of their father. Cain's work and sacrifice were in themselves no less honorable than Abel's, but they failed to bring him satisfaction and blessing, because his heart was not right. Genesis 4:5-7. He had evidently lost his faith and trust in God, and unrepentant and rebellious as he was, he permitted his mind to brood over God's favorable reception of Abel's sacrifices. Abel's whole attitude toward his labor and its blessing was shown by his cheerful willingness to devote the firstlings of his flock to the Lord. Genesis 4:4. And ever since, in the measure in which men have gone about their daily tasks with faith and gratitude toward God, and with intelligent interest and steady industry, they have, with his blessing, not only built sturdy, self-reliant characters, but have escaped many of the temptations which beset those whose heart, because of ingratitude and resentment, is not in their work. Rugged Palestine as the home of God's people. God called Abraham, the ancestor of his chosen people, out of the rich Tigris-Euphrates Valley to live in the mountains of Canaan. From the Promised Land, he took the patriarchal family to the fertile delta region of northern Egypt. He led their descendants about in the wilderness of Sinai for a generation. But these periods were only seasons of preparation for their role in world history. His people were not to be wealthy landlords or peasant slaves in Egypt or Babylonia, nor were they to become restless, wandering, fighting desert tribes. God chose for their permanent home the land of Canaan, where they could become a freedom-loving, independent people, each with his own farm or his own vineyard. The struggle for existence and its results. In Canaan, God's people could make their living as shepherds, but only through ceaseless watchfulness, industry, and faithfulness in their lonely task of caring for their flocks. Here they could wrest a good living from the soil, but only by long and back-breaking hours of labor. Here, too, they could grow grapes and other fruits successfully, but only by terracing the mountain slopes, maintaining the stone terrace walls, and guarding the vineyards against marauding men and animals. Only by careful planning and generations of devoted work could the country be made and kept a land of brooks of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. Deuteronomy 8:7-8. In this chosen land, the people of Israel were to find and work out their God-given destiny. As a result of their continuous struggle for existence, the hardy mountain shepherds and vine dressers, the farmers of the lowlands, the fishermen of Galilee and of the Mediterranean coast, built up a strong and self-reliant people, able to support itself and to defend itself against its enemies. Such was the blood of Samuel and David, and Amos and Isaiah, of Jesus and Peter and John and Paul. The value of studying ancient customs. What was the daily life of these people? How did they earn their living? What did they eat and drink and wear? How did they find shelter from heat and cold and rain? What were their interests and social customs? These questions are important, for though the Bible truths apply to all mankind, the Bible itself is built around the history of a people. Its characters act according to the customs of that people. Its parables are based on their daily life and activities. As we learn about these people, we shall feel more and more at home with them and grow in our understanding not only of Bible history, but also of the parables and the laws and the sermons and the doctrines which the Holy Spirit has woven into the historical pattern of the Scriptures. Hunting. Reasons for engaging in hunting. God expressly gave Noah and his sons the privilege of using animals for food, Genesis 9:3. But the first mention of hunting occurs in the case of Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, Genesis 10:9, who probably, as commentators have suggested, hunted wild animals for sport and adventure in the manner of the Babylonian nobility. David, on the contrary, had to kill a lion and a bear in order to protect his flocks. 1 Samuel 17:34 through 37. Esau went out to the field to hunt wild game from which to prepare savory meat, such as his father loved. Genesis 27:4. Other beasts of prey that were found in Palestine were lions, panthers, hyenas, jackals, foxes, wild boars, wolves, bears, and wild dogs. Thus, from the earliest times, the Hebrew people hunted wild animals and fowl in order to supplement their scant meat supply by eating deer, gazelle, antelope, mountain sheep, and goats, and other clean animals, as well as the various clean birds. The Judean farmer could spare his domestic flocks and herds, thus preserving his source of milk and wool. Weapons used in hunting. The hunting weapons mentioned in the Bible are those common to most ancient nations. The bow and arrow appear very early in the history of God's people and throughout biblical times, Genesis 27:3. The bow, made of wood, was small compared with the powerful longbow of the later North European races. It was strung with a thong of gut, hide, or sinew, or with a cord made of waxed cotton or linen. The arrows were about lead pencil thickness. Made of straight reeds or cut from straight-grained wood, they were tipped with bronze or iron arrowheads. The quiver, resembling a small golf bag, slung over the shoulder of the hunter, had a capacity of a dozen or more arrows. The short spears or darts for close hunting, the longer spear or javelin for long-distance throwing, as well as the lance, used like a modern bayonet for thrusting, were shafts of wood varying in length from 3 to 7 feet, ending in bronze or iron spearheads. The young Israelite became adept in the use of the sling, which might be his own 6-foot sash of cloth, holding one end of the sash firmly by winding it around his fingers and gripping the other end between his thumb and forefinger. The slinger placed a stone into the loop of the cloth. He then swung it rapidly at arm's length until, when it had attained great momentum, he released the loosely held end, permitting the stone to fly to its target. Used with an egg-sized stone as a missile, the sling was a powerful weapon, capable of killing the hardiest of wild animals. We need not be surprised that the stone slung by David sank deep into the forehead of Goliath, killing him instantly. 1 Samuel 17, verses 49 to 50. Methods used in trapping animals and birds. In order to catch the smaller animals or birds, the hunter used various types of nets and snares. He might stretch a coarse mesh net among the branches of trees along the route followed by birds in flight. he might make a noose of strong cord, one end of which he tied to the end of a sapling, which he had bent over and pegged to the ground. When a bird or animal pulled or scratched at the bait, the sapling snapped free from the peg and jerked the noose upwards, suspending the victim in midair. Jeremiah 5:26, Proverbs 7:23, Psalm 124:7, Amos 3:5. Larger clean animals, such as gazelles or goats, as well as marauding lions, jackals, and other beasts of prey, were commonly caught in pits. Dug into the path, usually followed by the animals as they went to drink, the pit was covered with a loose framework of small tree branches and reeds over which a thin layer of earth was carefully packed. This seemingly innocent part of the path gave way suddenly at the slightest pressure, throwing the unsuspecting animal into the pit, where it was at the mercy of the hunter. 2 Samuel 23:20. Humane treatment of animals. In order that the supply of wildlife might not be exhausted, the Hebrew law declared a closed season on game animals and birds every seventh year and allowed them to eat the balance of the unharvested crop after the poor had had their fill. Exodus 23:11, Leviticus 25:7. In appreciation of God's mercy to man, God expected him to be merciful to animals, a lesson which Christian teachers can well afford to impress upon their children. Psalm 104:21, Psalm 147:9, and Job 38:41. The blood of animals killed for food was permitted to soak into the ground. It was not eaten, but reverently covered with dust. Leviticus 17:13. Fishing. Israelite knowledge of fishing. The Old Testament does not describe the process of fishing, yet from quite a number of allusions to that occupation, we know that the Israelites knew about it, and they doubtless also practiced it to supplement their meat supply. Ezekiel 47:10. In the wilderness, the wandering tribes complained to Moses that he had deprived them of the fish of the river Nile. Numbers 11:5. At the time of Nehemiah, fish of the sea were sold on the market in Jerusalem. Nehemiah 13:16. And one entrance to Jerusalem had already been named the Fish Gate, no doubt because of the fish market in its vicinity. Nehemiah 12:39, 2 Chronicles 33:14. While the Old Testament contains only passing references, the New Testament gives us several extended accounts of fishing. Some of Jesus' disciples, Simon, Andrew, James, and John, had made their living by fishing on Lake Galilee before they began to follow Jesus, and occasionally they went back to their former occupation for a short time. Matthew 4:21, Luke 5:5-6, and John 21:3. The use of the net. Galilee still abounds in freshwater fish of many varieties, and Tiberias is still the home of many fishermen today. The favorite method of fishing used nets of various types, with mesh varying from coarse to fine according to the kind of fish they had intended to catch. The dip net consisted of a cone-shaped mesh held open by a wooden hoop formed from the thin end of a newly cut branch, the thicker end of which served as a handle. The casting net was about 10 feet in diameter. Weights around the edges pulled it down, and the fishermen pulled up the center cord, and this apparently narrowed the net, pulling in the fish until he could reach under the water or dive to gather the weighted ends of his arms and carry or drag the fish ashore. Isaiah 19:8, Ezekiel 32:3-4. This net called for individual dexterity and strength. The dragnet, about as long as a tennis net and perhaps three times as high, was stretched between two boats. Its top kept the water level by a series of floats, and the opposite edge held down by sinkers. The submerged net was dragged toward the shore between the boats, enclosing whatever fish happened to be in its way. The nets also became snagged in driftwood and other rubbish and had to be cleaned and washed occasionally. In Jesus' day, the dragnet was most used. The disciples came ashore, dragging the net with fishes. John 21, verse 8. This method is still used along the Mediterranean, where men put out the nets at night and gather them in from the shore in the morning. Sometimes men beat the water and threw stones to scare the fish from coming out of the ends of the net. In one of his parables, Jesus compares the kingdom of heaven to this type of net. Just as the dragnet brings all kinds of fish to the shore, where the fishermen separate the good from the bad, so shall it be at the end of the world. The angel shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just. Matthew 13, verses 47 to 50. Fishing on Lake Galilee was carried on largely by night, when the fish came in close to the shore to feed. Hence the surprise of Peter when Jesus asks him to row far out into the deep, and in the daytime at that. Luke 5:5. Spotting fish on the water by men standing high on the shore was a method often used. After the resurrection, Jesus appeared to seven of his disciples after they had fished all night and had caught nothing, and did that for them, at the same time performing a miracle in allowing them to make a tremendous catch of fish. John 21, verses 3 to 6. The dragnet teaches lessons in cooperation and teamwork. Fishing with hooks. Fish hooks are mentioned in Amos 4:2, Ezekiel 29:4, Job 41:1, and Matthew 17:27. No doubt they were used as extensively by Israel as by other neighboring peoples. All sizes of ancient hooks of iron and bronze have been preserved, from light ones, not over an inch in length, to very strong ones, capable of catching and holding the largest fish of the Nile. The shape of the ancient fish hooks is very much like those of our own day. The hooks mentioned in Amos 4:2 may refer to gaffs by means of which fish were pulled from the nets into the boats. The fish spear, or harpoon. The Egyptian fisherman permitted his boat to drift down the Nile while, statue-like, he knelt at the edge of the deck with spear poised, ready to drive it into the body of any large fish he might see. Though during their sojourn in Egypt, the Israelites certainly learned this use of spears or harpoons in the rich waters of the Egyptian delta, there is no biblical reference to this type of fishing in the Lake of Galilee or in the Jordan River. Development of apostles. Why so many fishermen in the small group of Jesus' disciples, especially since Jesus himself was a carpenter's son? Perhaps it was because, as fishermen, men like Peter and James and John had learned the value of hard work. They had learned to endure the disappointment of fishing a whole night and catching nothing. They had practiced patience through many a long hour of waiting. They had dared to face the treacherous storms of Lake Galilee. It was not by accident that Jesus chose people of this occupation to become fishers of men, an occupation in which they could use all the patience and strength and perseverance and courage which they had learned. Matthew 4:19. Grazing and sheep raising. Ranching in the East Country. Much of the windswept plateau east of the Jordan River was cattle country like our Southwest, and the strong bulls of Bashan, Psalm 22, verse 12, were as proverbial as our own, Texas longhorns. Pasturing their cattle in the open the year-round, the nomadic ranchers lived largely on meat and milk products, supplemented by the wild fruits, nuts, and herbs of the field, rather than by the products of a settled agriculture. They counted their wealth in cattle, the meats and hides of which furnished food, and raw materials for export to the larger cities. Great herds of donkeys and even of horses grazed on the grassy uplands and in the valleys, while on the fringes of the Syrian desert, camels were the chief source of wealth. Like Abraham, Job was a great rancher with vast herds of sheep, camels, oxen, and donkeys. Job 1:3. Hog raising. Hogs, unclean according to the Mosaic law, Leviticus 11:7, were not raised by the Israelites themselves, but in the far country, where, according to Luke 15, verses 13 to 16, the prodigal son wasted his substance and finally had to make his living by herding the hogs of a heathen citizen. And in the country of the Gerasenes, Mark 5:11, pigs were kept in large numbers by the non-Jewish population, as indeed they have been by most peoples throughout world history. The raising of sheep and goats. In Palestine proper, west of the Jordan, the land on which large herds of cattle could have grazed was too necessary for agricultural purposes to be set aside for pasture. A farmer might have a cow or two or a yoke of oxen, which he used to draw his wagon and agricultural implements. He used donkeys as beasts of burden about his farm and vineyard. In later times, he might even keep one camel for the same purpose. But the animals found in very large numbers were the sheep and goats, which could find a living in the uncleared wilderness, Luke 15:4, on the steep slopes and crags and in the ravines of the mountainous regions inaccessible to the larger cattle. Such flocks, often consisting of sheep and goats, which had to be separated at night, occupied the attention of a considerable part of the population. The equipment of a shepherd. The shepherd might be a village dweller who either devoted part of his time to the herding of sheep, besides carrying on agriculture, or gave all his energies to the work of caring for his flock. In either case, he needed about the same type of equipment. Since he had to be self-sufficient for days or weeks at a time while he was pasturing his sheep in out-of-the-way places, his kit had to be complete, yet compact, and light enough so that he could carry it along with him. For the protection of his sheep, he needed his rod and staff, Psalm 23:4. The rod was a club about 2 feet long, sometimes with knotty knots at the thick end, while the thinner end he gripped in his hand or attached to his sash by a leather cord strung through a hole in the handle. This was a formidable weapon for the defense of his sheep against robbers or wild animals. The shepherd used his staff, a straight sapling about 6 or 7 feet long, tapered at one end without a crook, as Western pictures show, to guide his sheep, to knock off twigs and leaves from the trees for their food, and to assist himself in climbing steep and rocky hillsides and treacherous ravines in search of food, water, and shelter for his flock. The traditional shepherd's crook of the Christian art seems to be a European rather than a Palestinian staff. Like the hunter, the shepherd carried his sling and a few smooth stones in his shepherd's bag or purse for defense against marauders, animal or human. The sling was made of 2 long cords of woven goat's hair, sinews or leather with a leather or a woolen pocket fastened to them. This pocket could hold a flint or limestone about 2 or 3 inches in diameter. David used his sling to fell the giant Goliath, 1 Samuel 17:40. Among all this people, there were 700 chosen men, left-handed, everyone who could sling stones at a hair's breadth and not miss. Judges 20, verse 16. His purse also held his noonday lunch of dried figs, olives or raisins, cheese and bread, or parched wheat. At his sash hung a clay flask or a hollow gourd, which served as a container for milk or water. He might also carry a horn of olive oil in the same way. His heavy cloak of sheepskin, goat hair, or camel hair, or of homespun wool, draped over his shoulders and held in with a sash at the waist, served him as a coat by day and a cover by night. In the fold above his sash, at his bosom, he could find room for a sick or injured lamb, Isaiah 40:11, which would have perished without his help. On his head, he wore the usual square cotton cloth folded into a triangle and held in place about his temples by a woven halo of wool. Thus equipped, he was ready to battle the elements or his enemies in the care and defense of his sheep for days or even weeks at a time. While it was not an essential piece of equipment, the shepherd often carried a reed pipe on which he played his kind of simple, haunting music. The construction of the sheepfold. The sheepfold might be a cave reaching far back into the limestone cliff. Such caves have been occupied in Palestine by successive generations of shepherds since the days of the judges, and even of Israel's predecessors, the Canaanite tribes. Some distance in front of the cave, the shepherd might build a wall of rock, about 6 feet high, with only one door through which he and his sheep could enter. John 10:1. Sometimes the wall had thorns planted along the top to keep out marauding wolves or thieves. Thus the sheep would have a warm stable and an open courtyard where they could be protected from their enemies and yet sleep in the open air under the stars in pleasant weather. When Gad and Reuben inherited the east country before Palestine was conquered, they built sheepfolds for the protection of their flocks, Numbers 32:16. Where caves were not available, the shepherd built his enclosing wall of rock in the same way, but roofed it over at one end in order to make a weatherproof stable for the sheep. The interior of the stable was reached by archways opening out into the courtyard. Such a sheepfold, surrounded by its stone wall and defended by the shepherds, became a fortress for the protection of the sheep. The shepherd built himself a booth or a stone shelter within the enclosure, often open to the sky. The shepherd and his sheep. Pasturing the sheep. In the mountains of Judea, there were few safe open meadows where sheep could be left unguarded by day or night. In the daytime, the shepherds sought out the best pasture, away back in the recesses of a winding ravine, or on a grassy slope which he could reach only by carefully leading the sheep over dangerous mountain paths. He led them to the still waters where they could drink without danger of falling into the swift current or the terrifying rapids. He let them rest in the shade of the trees or where some great rock cast a welcome shadow. Isaiah 32:2. While they rested, he watched, either sitting on a rock or leaning on his staff, so as always to be within their sight. Should they become frightened, they might stampede in fear. Meanwhile, he might be playing simple music on a shepherd's pipe, which he could lay aside in a second in order to free his hands for the use of his sling or his club. Back to the fold. It was necessary for the shepherd to be able to read the signs of the sky, and at the first sign of a threatening storm, or in any case by mid-afternoon, he called his sheep together, or they were driven by the dogs, who were ferocious animals, dangerous both to strangers and wild animals, and headed for home, so as not to risk their lives either in a sudden flood or in the darkness. The shepherd did not drive his sheep, but walked ahead of them, calling gently to those that showed signs of weariness and carefully seeing that each wanderer returned to the flock. Then standing in his sheepfold door, he called them by name as they crowded past him, again making sure that none were missing. Flocks might be small as a dozen or two, or they might run up to at least 100, as we see from the parable of the lost sheep, Luke 15, verse 4. Dangers of the night. But not all the danger was past when the shepherd had led his sheep safely into the fold. The enemy might strike in the dead of night. So the shepherd watched over his flocks from the top of the wall or roof or dozed by his campfire while the flock slept. In case of an attack by robbers or by wolves, a shepherd worthy of the name did not flee, but was ready to give his life for his sheep. With no thought of self-preservation, he bravely stood up against his enemies, until either he or they were defeated. The Good Shepherd. What a picture the shepherd passages give us of the Savior. No wonder the Lord chose the dependence of sheep upon the shepherd to explain the relationship between himself and his people. He is the keeper of Israel, who neither slumbers nor sleeps. Psalm 121, verse 4, Psalm 80, verse 1. It is he who makes his sheep to lie down in green pastures and leads them beside the still waters. Psalm 23, verse 2. Feeding his flock like a shepherd. Isaiah 40:11, Psalm 79:13, Psalm 95:7, Ezekiel 34:14. Even in the valley where death casts its terrifying shadows, they need not fear, for he is with them, comforting them with his reassuring presence. Psalm 23:4. I have gone astray like a lost sheep. Psalm 119, verse 76. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And instead of punishing us, the Lord hath laid upon him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Isaiah 53, verses 6 to 7. This prophetic passage finds its fulfillment in Jesus, the good shepherd, who giveth his life for the sheep. John 10:11, John 19:30. He it is who restores those who have strayed away. 1 Peter 2:25, carrying them home upon his shoulders rejoicing. Luke 15:5. It is he who turns them over to under-shepherds like Peter and all Christian pastors and teachers since, with the commission, feed my lambs, feed my sheep, a commission which has as its one great condition the searching question, lovest thou me? John 21:15-17. And with this vital condition fulfilled, in the measure that we become better acquainted with our good shepherd and study his word and imitate his methods, and, above all, reflect more and more of his unselfish love, we shall be successful in finding and bringing in and teaching his lambs until there will be one fold and one shepherd. John 10:16. Review questions and exercises. Enumerate the advantages of a definite work program for man, A, before the fall, and B, after the fall. Number two, what were some of the advantages of Palestine as compared with the Nile Delta or the Sinai Desert as a permanent home for God's people? Number three, in connection with the occupation of hunting, be prepared to sketch roughly and to describe briefly the method of using the following. A, a bow, an arrow, and quiver. B, darts, javelin, and lance. C, the sling and its missile. D, nets and snares. E, pits. Number four, describe and sketch the following equipment of the Palestinian fishermen. A, a dip net. B, a drag net. C, casting net. D, a hook. E, a harpoon. Number five, picture the environment and life of the people in the cattle country east of the Jordan and on the fringes of the Syrian desert. 6. Why was Palestine proper largely devoted to the raising of sheep? Describe a sheepfold. Number 7. Describe the shepherd's equipment. A. Rod and staff. B. Purse and its contents. C. Horn of oil and its uses. 8. Study and be ready to interpret briefly A, Psalm 23, B, the parable of the good shepherd, and C, the parable of the lost sheep. Problems for further study. Number one, what motivation can you furnish for Sunday school children to look forward to a useful life rather than a life of ease? Number two, how can the mercy and forethought of God in the preservation of wildlife be used in properly molding the attitudes of children toward animals? Number three, through a study of the New Testament passages concerning fishing, develop the thought in Jesus' words, I will make you fishers of men, Matthew 4:19. Number four, study Psalm 22 and try to determine what the suffering saver meant by wild bulls of Bashan have beset me round. Number five, compare the character and actions of A, the sheep and the goats, B, the hireling and the shepherd, and develop an application of each to the life of the class or the teacher or both. This ends chapter one of Home Life and Bible Times, written and illustrated by Arthur W. Klink.